It is 7:30, time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Jill Freeburg. Jill Freeburg is founder of Corrugated Films and producer of the new documentary film Granito de Arena, which is translated into Grain of Sand. She's also co-producer of the documentary This is What Democracy Looks Like and one of the many founders of the Seattle IMC, Seattle Independent Media Center. Jill, thanks for coming in this morning.
Thanks, Mike.
Let's start out and talk about your latest work, Granito de Arena. Tell us what the motivation for that was.
Well, the most general terms, what I wanted to do was raise the question, what should be the role of a school teacher in an era of economic globalization or neoliberalism? And on more specific terms, I wanted to make a film that could highlight the ideology and the policies behind what could be called the public education crisis, the destabilization and privatization of public education that's happening everywhere in the world, including in the U.S., but to highlight those issues through a story of resistance. So not to make a film that that just you walk out of the theater afterwards and you feel worse than when you walked in, but that could inform and educate, but also inspire and mobilize. So I looked to Mexico, where school teachers have a long history of resistance and are to this day fighting a grassroots nonviolent struggle to defend public education.
All right. And I have to admit, I mean, I was totally unaware of what was going on down there. Maybe you can fill us in on some of the history of the teachers' movement there.
It's a movement that, well, to go way back, in Mexico, the role of school teachers, especially in rural Mexico, a school teacher historically was often placed by communities in a role of leadership in the community, because they'd often be they'd arrive in a rural community and be the only ones who could read or write, or be, in some cases in indigenous parts of Mexico, be the only ones who spoke Spanish well enough, but they would be living in the community and experiencing the same conditions as everyone else in the community, so they would often end up in these roles of leading resistance or mobilization from the community to demand basic services or that other needs be met for the community. And often the teacher was placed in this role of being the community medic, the community expert on agriculture or animal husbandry, as they call it. And a lot of social leaders and radical movement leaders in Mexico's history were school teachers. A lot of the mentors and advisor to Emiliano Zapata were school teachers, and some of the armed resistance movements that rose up in rural Mexico in the 70s were founded by school teachers. And so in the late 70s, a movement emerged out of the southern Mexican state of Chiapas of school teachers who had seen the state of Chiapas growing wealthy off of its oil reserves, but the communities of Chiapas actually seeing fewer and fewer resources. And in a lot of communities, teachers were actually going for months without getting paid at all. And at the same time, the teachers' union is the largest union in the Western Hemisphere and conceivably the most corrupt. So teachers who are trying to confront these very fundamental issues of not having enough resources for themselves, but also working in communities that had no resources, if they tried to actually change their situation, were immediately confronted with brutal union corruption and were risking their lives. So this movement emerged that was, on a very basic level, demanding more resources for public education for the communities where they worked, but also demanding union democracy. And it was a movement that came out of years of organizing in the, you know, with and in communities in rural Chiapas, so that when it actually emerged as a movement, it enjoyed incredible community support and from parents and other community members, and really exploded as a movement. Within a few years, over 100,000 teachers were participating in almost all of southern Mexico, Chiapas, Oaxaca, Tabasco. It spread to Mexico City. There were massive strikes. And several states actually managed to democratize the union at the state level and increase teachers' wages and several other victories that they achieved in the first years of the movement. And the movement really started right when neoliberalism, or the what we consider economic globalization in this country, was really arriving in Mexico in full force in terms of the way we understand neoliberalism, the neoliberalism that emerged during the Reagan-Thatcher era. And it was arriving in Mexico. And the film sort of tracks that history of economic globalization in Mexico, especially in the realm of public education, parallel to the story of the teachers' movement, which really has evolved parallel to that history of neoliberalism in Mexico up to today, where the movement is very different from what it was in 1979, has had to adapt its demands as things like privatization and commercialization of public education have become much bigger issues for them, and they're still fighting to democratize their union, which is probably an eternal struggle. It won't be something that, you know, one day, woo, everything's democratic and everybody's happy. And the movement has also had to, I mean, most of the teachers in the movement and a lot of the teachers in the film are also recognizing that movement is also in what they're calling a currently in a crisis for lots of different reasons. But they're right now having to sort of rethink their tactics and their strategies and how they actually organize, because they've lost a lot of the community support that they had in the past. So the movement's right now in a very, in a place where I think a lot of school teachers in this country find themselves, which is how do teachers fight for education, but together with parents and other people in the community who care about public education in a way that includes everyone, and as opposed to excluding them or creating divisions.
Yeah, it was amazing just looking at everything the teachers in Mexico were up against. I mean, they had globalization is one of the factors, reforming a union, which I didn't realize until you just said that. It was the largest in the Western Hemisphere. It just problems that you have with schools themselves, you know, trying to produce curriculum and that these a lot of the teachers you featured in the film held multiple jobs. Had to pay for, I mean, the amount of, that the teachers and local families had to pay just to support these schools that were literally falling apart. And on top of that, the repression there in Mexico, which I think you quoted in the film that at one point in time there was like 150 disappearances or assassinations of teachers.
Yeah, since the movement began, that's the current number, is that over 150 teachers have been assassinated and disappeared. And most of those disappearances and assassinations are blamed on the union leadership. But in some cases, those were teachers who were involving themselves a little bit too much in more generally in organizing on behalf of and with farmers or fishermen, other, you know, rural communities. And so in those cases, they were probably more likely disappeared or assassinated by the army, the state, but most of those are blamed on union leadership. So, and, you know, I mean, I've seen historically the marches and protests were met by with a lot more police violence, you know, when they would occupy all the, you know, main streets in the center of Mexico City, for example. You know, the riot cops would show up and, you know, beat the crap out of all the teachers they could get their hands on and let the dogs loose on them. And I saw less of that when I was filming. I think the government's sort of changing its tactics and saying, well, maybe if we just let them sit out there in the sun for a few days, they'll go home. But there is, I mean, there's footage in the film of some pretty severe police brutality from 2003 on teachers and students. So yeah, they are up against a lot. They're up against incredible union repression, state repression, very scarce resources. And then just having to survive, which for anyone in Mexico, especially since NAFTA, has gotten a lot more difficult. And they're also up against a mainstream media in Mexico, which has also evolved over time, as has the mainstream media in our own country. So that a part of the reason that the movement has lost community support is that if you turn on the television or the radio in Mexico when there's a school teacher protest, you hear reports very similar to what you would hear here, which is that the teachers are lazy and their responsibility is to be in the classroom, and that, you know, going out on strike only jeopardizes the educational experience of their students, and all they're asking for is a raise anyway. I mean, you never hear their list of demands that they're actually negotiating, like free school breakfasts, free eyeglasses for all the students in the state of Michoacán, free textbooks, or that they're, what they're opposing, that they're imposing privatization policies that look a lot like No Child Left Behind. You never hear about that. You just hear, slick TV anchors saying, well, the teachers are out in the streets once again, and traffic is bad because of it, and kids are out of school. So they're up against that as well.
Yeah, it was amazing the parallels between what I was seeing through your film that are happening down there and things that are happening to our schools here, although it's obviously they're dealing with a lot more hurdles down there than we have here. But just, for instance, the standardized testing, how much that came up.
Yeah, and standardized testing is a lot newer in Mexico than it is in the U.S., but it's the private agency in Mexico that's responsible for administering and writing a lot of the standardized tests used at different levels in Mexico. Basically came up to the U.S. to study and blueprint. What's the standardized testing agency in this country? Now I can't remember what it's called. They really, they thought, well, we could just go up to the States and see how they're doing it and replicate that model in Mexico, which is, also a country with incredible, if diversity is the right word. I mean, it is a country with incredible diversity, but in terms of spectrum of economic access and privilege, and also a racial spectrum, where you have poor indigenous kids for whom Spanish is a second language taking the same standardized test as, middle-class kids from Mexico City. But it's especially of concern in Mexico because a free and secular public education is actually in the Mexican Constitution, which it's not in this country. It was a product of the Mexican Revolution. And they had to tweak that part of the Constitution when they were negotiating the North American Free Trade Agreement. And that the impacts of that since 1994 have been felt more in higher education in Mexico than in elementary and secondary education. But thousands and thousands of 16-year-olds are being basically having their educational opportunities cut short at the age of 16 now because of a standardized test that they're required to take after the age of 16 if they want to continue studying at any of the country's public universities, which are actually still free, at least in theory. So you have literally thousands of students every year who have absolutely no economic possibility of paying to go to school after the age of 16, who line up by the thousands to take this exam. It's called el examen único, and don't pass, and that's it. I mean, and there've been students who have committed suicide after getting the results of their exam and finding out that they failed, because it basically means your hope for ever getting out of your current economic situation, and probably also for the hope to be able to turn around and economically support your family, was just cut short by this one standardized exam. And they're also applying it at the elementary and secondary level in a way it looks very similar to the U.S., which is basically telling individual public schools, if you want more resources, you can sign up for this program called Quality Schools and work harder, and we'll give you more resources. But the way we'll know you're working harder is we're going to subject your students to a lot more tests, and many of them are standardized. And then what they get in return for that is an injection of resources that really should be obligatory for all of the schools, enough money to get the toilets working again or put some books in the library. So when I started learning about that program, it really was creeping me out how much it looked like what's happening up here.
Again, it seemed like your film really illustrated a lot of the problems that we have here, but also the bigger connections here with people. You don't really hear much in the debate, for instance, let's say, about immigration currently. Why do people, want to come to the U.S.? And, of course, the mantra that's repeated in mainstream media as well, because of all the great things we have here, our freedoms and, all the perks and stuff. But they leave out the part where the economic exports mm-hmm. that we give to, for instance, to Mexico through NAFTA, mm-hmm. that forces these people to come here because mm-hmm. we're just devastating that country.
Yeah, and I mean, you see, you definitely see that in public schools in Mexico. I mean, there's urban belts, what they call cinturas de miseria in Mexico, which is like, you know, misery belts that line large urban centers like Mexico City, where I was just reading an article in Ciudad Neza, which is a urban sort of area right on the edge of Mexico City, where they're having to close a bunch of the schools because so many of the students split, like left. And if you're leaving Mexico City to migrate anywhere, you're migrating to the U.S. because rural Mexico, you know, you leave rural Mexico and go to Mexico City. And when that doesn't work out for you, you leave and go to the U.S. So, and I've been to communities in rural Oaxaca that are literally ghost towns. I mean, the only people there are old people and women and children, and that all of the men have left to go to the U.S. And you know, the lack of educational opportunity feeds that. I mean, people leave for a lot of reasons. Farmers have been displaced because corn imports from the U.S. flooded the Mexican market, and Mexican corn farmers couldn't make a living anymore. Mexican coffee farmers couldn't make a living anymore. There's lots of different factors that are feeding that economic desperation that drives people to migrate. But also, if you fail a standardized exam at age 16 and see that you have no possibility to study beyond the age of 16, you can stay in Mexico and work in a sweatshop, or you can go to the U.S. and see if you can make a little bit more money for yourself and for your family. But the decision to risk your life crossing the U.S. border is not a decision that people make lightly because they want to see if they can, you know, come up here and get an iPod. It's a life and death decision that people make that means that they're leaving behind their whole family in many cases, unless they take some of them with them, with no idea of when they'll be able to come back and even if they'll make it back alive. So that argument that people are coming here because they want what we have, I think, is simplistic and inaccurate and unfortunate.
Yet, despite everything they're up against down there, they have one of the most inspiring movements. I mean, true throughout Latin America, but definitely in what you're focused on in the film. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the teachers' movement has been a source of a lot of inspiration for me. I also learned a lot from it in terms of, for a movement that's been around for 25 years and that has encountered a lot of the difficulties that movements that exist for that long encounter. You know, I don't want to sugarcoat it. You know, there's a lot of issues within the teachers' movement of corruption that's managed to make its way into the movement. A lot of people arguing that the democratic teachers aren't really all that democratic, and especially the biggest criticism being that they've managed to sustain this incredibly militant, although that word is used, anyway, political struggle, but that they've made very little progress in any kind of pedagogical struggle in terms of actually democratizing education. But I think it's nevertheless a source of inspiration for me, and I think it's also in keeping with the history of resistance that Mexico has, whether it's school teachers or farmers or health workers or students, that in the face of pretty daunting repression, historically, Mexico has always, there's people in Mexico who are still alive who were around for the Mexican Revolution. You know, it's not a moment in ancient history for them. It's a part of their lives, and resistance is a part of people's lives. And I think the teachers' movement is just one example of that. But I think it's an important example because there seems to be an idea in lots of places in the world that the role of a school teacher is not just to be an educator. I mean, the teachers in Mexico have this chant, El maestro luchando también está enseñando, which basically means a teacher in struggle is also teaching. A teacher who's out in the street protesting is still teaching by modeling for their students how you don't stay on your knees, you know, how you fight for what you believe in. And it seems to, that ideology, whatever you want to call it, seems to apply in lots of places in the world. But you see it a lot less in countries like the U.S. and to a lesser extent in Canada, that idea that teachers are also agents of social change, and that that sometimes actually means having to leave the classroom or having to make waves within the classroom and also outside of the classroom.
Seems like, you know, with all the years that the North has been sucking the resources out of the South, that to me it's like one of the ironies is that the very changes that are occurring in the South will be one of the resources that very well might save the North in the long run.
You mean in terms of political change? Yeah, I mean, right now is a very interesting time in terms of lots of different parts of Latin America electing at least supposedly left governments, remains to be seen. And, you know, social movements like the Zapatista movement really sort of setting new examples and raising new questions about how to mobilize for social change, for social and economic justice. And one would hope that there'll be enough stirring south of the border that people north of the border will start paying attention. And that was that was one of my goals in making the film is to generate some more cross-border solidarity between school teachers in the U.S. and Mexico. I mean, the entire time I was making the film, my primary audience that I kept in mind was school teachers and school teachers-to-be in the U.S. and Canada. And I mean, I've shown it in a lot of other places and to a lot of other audiences, and it's been very well received there as well. But my hope was not that school teachers in the U.S. and Canada would say, oh, there's poor teachers in Mexico, we have to go help them, but that they would see the teachers in Mexico, see their experience reflected in their own experience here, and maybe start thinking and talking about ways to resist here, which would be different. I mean, the Mexico and the U.S. are vastly different in so many ways, historically and contemporarily and socially, economically, culturally, everything else. But I still think that there's a lot of lessons to be learned from, in this case, from the school teachers, but also from a lot of other forms of resistance in Latin America. There's a lot of lessons that can be learned and applied to what we face in this country without trying to actually replicate it, but actually think about what's appropriate in this country and how should people be struggling. In this case, how should school teachers be fighting in defense of public education in this country? I mean, you know, school teachers in Mexico haven't organized a lot specifically around standardized testing because it's so new there. But it would sure be great, for example, to see all of the teachers in Washington State just refuse to administer the WASL. You know, that would be a form of resistance that would have a huge impact and would be very different than how teachers in Mexico are resisting, but it would be a response, which would be great to see, to the policies that are being imposed on public education here.
One of the things that you clarify in the film, but that we haven't really clarified here, is when we're talking about standardized testing, I mean, if you're unfamiliar with the intricacies of it, I mean, it sounds like a good thing, standardized testing. I mean, it's like, why shouldn't we standardize it so that, you know, standardize our cars? You know, they all have doors and wheels and whatever. But as you point out in the film, the end result appears to be a shaping of people so that they're ideal for the large industries. And one of the terms that comes up a lot in the film is human capital.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot, it's very common to talk about public education in the context of talking about economic models and economic efficiency, like it'll serve our state and national economy if people are going to school and the schools are functioning, which to me is offensive on a most sort of fundamental level to talk about people's sort of the act of learning and the act of teaching as being a sort of cog in the wheel of an economic model. But also because it's coming from a place where it's coming from the same people who are generating policies like No Child Left Behind, which use standardized testing to sort people and use standardized testing to open the door for privatization. I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to recognize that if you take a school that's already struggling economically, that's in a neighborhood with a student population that's coming to school with a lot of other issues like, you know, drug abuse in the home, or they didn't have breakfast, or they didn't have dinner the night before, and you take that school and you say, do well on this test or else you are going to cut your funding, or we're going to provide vouchers to the parents of your students so they can go off to a private religious school, doesn't take a rocket scientist to recognize that the end result of that is that those schools close, those student populations are not served in terms of educational opportunities, and that what comes up in their place are private sector models. And so you have an entire student populations who have their educational opportunities so limited by that process and by other processes of social and economic injustice that their economic opportunities dictate almost that they end up in a low-wage workforce, which we need a lot of, and that the students who go to schools that are already in a position to excel on those tests, which would be schools in more economically privileged neighborhoods, students who have maybe one parent who's not working, who has time to read to them in the afternoon because they don't have to go off and work a second or a third minimum wage job, that those schools will excel on the tests. Those students will get scholarships or have enough economic privilege already to go on and study at a four-year university. And those are the ones that will not be sorted into the low-wage workforce. So to me, I see it as it's not a conspiracy. It's very strategic. We can't have everybody graduating from Harvard Business School and going off to run Coca-Cola or whatever the outcome would be. We need people to work at Walmart and McDonald's, and one way to maintain that process is to sort people out at a very young age, and to open the door to the private sector, which is really itching to get access to public education. And what better way to do that than to hold up a test sheet, a record of test scores in a certain neighborhood for the last 3 years, and say, this district ain't working. And in comes a company like Edison, which it did with the Philadelphia school district, and say, ooh, let us try. I bet we can run it better, which has yet to ever be proven to be the case. But there's definitely a lot of private interests that are, rubbing their hands together with the hope that they can get that kind of access to not just the public sector. I mean, not just public education, all aspects of the public sector, but...
Where can people find out more about your film and corrugated films?
Well, my website is www.corrugate.org, as in corrugated films. That's corrugate.org. And there's a whole website as part of that site about the film, and including an upcoming screenings page where you will find, if you're a Seattle listener, information about a screening at the University of Washington on March 1st and at Green River Community College on March 7th. And if you're listening anywhere else in the country, there's a bunch of upcoming screenings in places like New York and San Francisco and Arizona and Caracas, Venezuela, and places like that. So corrugate.org is where you can find out all that info. And also there's a lot of links to background information about the teachers' movement and public education in Mexico and free trade policy as relates to public education.
And if people are interested in getting a copy of the
You can
video,
buy it on the website.
Or if they want to do their own showing of it, then you can
right.
Go through the website as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, there's a lot of information on the site about how to organize a screening, and we encourage people to do that and, let me know so we know kind of where the film is and who's seeing it. But to check out the film and set up screenings for your friends, and especially if you're a school teacher, to get all your school teacher co-workers together and watch it and talk about it.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
Just been talking with Jill Friedberg. She is founder of Corrugated Films and producer of the new documentary film Granito de Arena. And again, you can find out more via her website at corrugate.org.